All right, it is Friday, so I want to turn right to our week in review. And joining me here in the studio is Tito Jackson. He's CEO of Vernant Medical and a former Boston City Councilor. Tito, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us, former Minority Leader of the Massachusetts Senate, Richard Tessay, is here. Richard, thanks
to
you as well.
Nice to see you again.
So we'll start with a little bit. I know this is a story that just broke a few hours ago. I had to send you guys an email saying, hey, a little bit of a change of plans here. But what do you make of the news of Robert Kraft?
Well, you know, usually at this time of year, everybody's talking about, you know, expected to have some type of postseason drama, whether or not Brady or Belichick were going to stay or go, or
Gronk retiring.
And I don't think anybody obviously could have predicted that it would be something like this. And I know that a lot of people, not only is Mr. Kraft respected, but he's beloved by many people in New England. And it's obviously sad to see him caught up in this. Again, these are accusations at this point, and I think most people would give him the benefit of the doubt and let it play out a little.
Yeah. Tito, I'd ask you, I mean, the police allegations are that this is a place where these women were held in sexual servitude. Kind of, what are the implications here?
Yeah. And, you know, the implications are far and wide, as just noted. Obviously, Mr. Kraft, as well as the Kraft family, have a huge presence and are a very present ownership team in Boston and the New England area. But these are serious charges and particular, and again, these are alleged charges here. This would be a very, very big mistake if he were to have been involved in this. The issue of human trafficking is something that's real. We have to take it as something that's serious. And in particular, in this case, even a heightened level of some of the things that we haven't actually seen in other cases. So I obviously know this is going to play out. But again, it is, you know, a troubling and pretty sad situation.
Yeah, we'll obviously continue to follow that story. We also had some breaking news today in the world of politics. House Democrats have now officially introduced a resolution to block President Trump's national emergency declaration. As of our last check, it's being co-sponsored by more than 220 Democrats and one Republican. Haven't found the name there yet, but at least one Republican in the House. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi scheduled a floor vote for Tuesday. We actually spoke to Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch about this earlier this week. He said he supports this legislative effort, but he's not sure it will go anywhere.
So, yeah, there'll be a legislative effort. I tend to think, however, that it may end up in court at some point, questioning the president's ability to use funds already approved by Congress for another purpose.
So what do you guys make of this resolution? Is there any chance that this passes the House and the Senate?
When you said there was another breaking news, I thought it was somebody else announcing for president today.
Yeah, wait 10 minutes. I'm sure we'll
have one about every.
Richard, I think we have time and opportunity.
But, you know, on this, I do think that, you know, there's a process that's going to play out. Obviously, I do think Trump is on somewhat, you know, it isn't like he has a pen and a phone like Obama. In this case, there is a law that was in place that he's. That he acted on. And the legislature, the Congress has the perfect right to disavow it and, you know, and take a vote. And he has the right to veto it. And it's going to end up in the courts. And we'll have to see what ends up happening with it.
Whether or not the executive order passes, I'm sorry, this kind of smack on the hand in terms of resolution, this is shaky ground. This is absolute executive overreach. And the reason why, and again, we can go back to constitutional law, there's some basic elements to the three branches that we actually have, and in particular with this issue of budgeting. And what you see, and for people who say that they support the military, understand where these dollars are coming from. These are preordained, I think it's over $3 billion in money and capital upgrades to military facilities across the world, right? So that is very, very problematic that these are pre-programmed dollars that are being extracted from the military, and there's no strategy here, right? But so this extraction of money is not a strategic extraction. It is a mass grab for political reasons by the President of the United States. Wrong, and I don't believe he will win.
So the legal challenges there are interesting, and we actually had an interview in the WBUR newsroom today with Senator Ed Markey, Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. And he talked pretty skeptically about this resolution to overturn the emergency, basically says doesn't believe it can defeat a presidential veto.
The president can veto it, and it would come back for the veto override. And there, it's highly unlikely, you know, that we would be able to get those additional votes to go up to 67 to override the veto.
So probably likely. I think most people agree that they're not going to hit that threshold. That being said, there is a question of whether or not there will be some Republicans who do end up siding with the Democrats on this. Maine Senator Susan Collins had said, if this is a clean resolution, I'll sign it. So I think there are some political stakes here. What do you make of this move to basically get all senators on record as either for or against?
I think it's fine. And again, this was a law that the Congress passed in the 1970s, giving the president the authority, if he deemed there to be an emergency, to be able to move money around from one account to another, to use it to take care of the emergency. Whether or not everybody would consider what he's using it for to be an emergency or not, that, I guess, is going to be the, you know, the question. But, you know, I think when you just look at this whole situation, whether it's on the Democratic side or the Republican side, you have a lot of people, you know, you had Democrats supporting border security a few years ago. Now they're against it. The Republicans are usually more keeping everybody in their constitutional lanes, and now they're a little more flexible with that. And, you know, at the end of the day, there's a lot of politics going on.
Flint, Michigan is an emergency. Puerto Rico is an emergency. To have the president snatch funds from the military, reprogram them into a place that he deems an emergency, that's not data-driven or empirically driven, while Americans in several places are still being harmed, to me, really begs the question what the definition of an emergency is. Getting people on record is absolutely critical. That for future elections, we need to know where you stood, because it is absolutely critical to determine whether or not you are on the right side of history or the wrong side of history.
It cuts both ways, because a lot of people feel as though we have a drug epidemic right now. That's an emergency. You have all these deaths all across the country, and 90% of the drugs are coming across the southern border. So, you know, I guess it all depends where you're coming from.
But they're not. But they're coming through, and, you know, we've seen time and time again. Oftentimes, they come. Most of the time, they're coming through on ships or on actual trucks that are going through the borders. So when it comes down to this idea of, we don't have to go back too far in history to see the whole wall thing does not work. The smart people in this space are speaking about technology, about cameras, and the ability to have rapid deployment to deal with these issues. And in fact, the number of people coming over the border has actually gone down. And the new folks who are actually coming are based on humanitarian crises that are in Central and South America. And we need to be helping those countries stabilize, because that actually will stem the tide of people moving towards our border.
Gallup recently did a poll in South America. A lot of these Central American countries, and it was something like 10 million people want to come to the United States. So I guess, and we're a welcoming country, but I guess the question is, do you let 10 million people across the border? And, you know, given the fact that there have been so many people who have come across, you know, what, I guess, and who's, some people don't think it's a problem at all. They're like Beto O'Rourke came out and said we shouldn't have any wall and we should have open borders. Then other people are totally on the other side and think that there should be one wall all the way across. You know, I personally think that you have to have, a bunch of different.
But when you have countries like Honduras that have murder rates that are actually higher than that of Iraq and Afghanistan, you really have to think about being strategic. And so as the president is going to Vietnam to visit with the leader of the northern section of Korea, he could actually be doing some things to actually take a leadership role in the Americas and actually lead. And instead of tweeting, get off of Twitter and actually step forward and use diplomacy as an actual verb rather than the adjective that it is under this administration.
All right, we could stay on this all day, but unfortunately have to move on. I know. But you mentioned strategic. Speaking of strategic, on the presidential front, we had got some more news this week. As Richard, you kind of implied, another New England politician threw his name into the 2020 race.
So, Senator Sanders, you're going to run for president. I am going to run for president. That's correct.
What's going to be different this time?
We're going to win.
So that obviously Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders on CBS This Morning. His camp actually says they raised about $6 million in the first 24 hours after he announced. What do you make of Bernie Sanders throwing his hat into the ring?
Amazing that in this day and age, you know, you can raise $6 million. And it's all small donors, too. He's going to stay in the race till he can stand until the end, basically. But I do think that the day he announced is the highest, you know, and the best day of he's going to have during the campaign, because as things go on, you know, he was successful last time in marshaling a lot of support, but a lot of his support, I think, was a lot of anti-Clinton support as well. And now you have like a lot of different choices for people to make. And so he's going to run, but I'm not so sure that he's going to have the same type of firepower that he did four years ago.
Tito, let me throw it to you. Crowded field, is he going to be able to stand out from the pack this
time? Well, I think Bernie has already stood out from the pack. I think both Richard and I would take $6 million in our first 12 million hours of actually raising when it comes down to being able to marshal those resources. But I think it actually speaks to Bernie Sanders strategically being a winner regardless of whether or not he wins. He has changed the way this conversation has happened. He has actually really led a conversation that has pulled Democrats to the left and actually back to where they should be. You had people who voted for Barack Obama and then voted for Donald Trump. And that, when we look at the Democratic Party, that's their fault when you lose that electorate. And so I think what you're hearing, and we have to say, you know, toss out AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, as also one of those folks who was actually pulling folks to that left. As the right is going even further right, I think it's absolutely critical that Democrats actually stand up for the people that they're sent there to represent. And I think Bernie absolutely is a leader in that space. But there's a lot of folks who are on that bandwagon now, and he's not the only one speaking to that.
So speaking of that, it was a pretty busy week in New Hampshire this week. It's obviously the battleground for the first in the nation primary. Three Democratic hopefuls made their first official visits this week. You had California Senator Kamala Harris. She said, despite experts predicting she's going to struggle in New Hampshire, that she is committed to making the Granite State a priority.
I plan on spending time in New Hampshire. I plan on competing in New Hampshire. I plan on doing very well in New Hampshire.
And as he's done at many of his campaign stops across the country, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker focused on a message of unity.
Reviving ideals of a more courageous empathy, that is the ingredients that makes our nation great.
And you also had Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, who delivered a message of bipartisanship.
We need to walk over this sturdy bridge that is our democracy, and that we need to get to higher ground in our politics.
So you guys have alluded, it's a very crowded field. Do you feel that any candidates have excelled at kind of separating from the pack?
I would just say I saw a poll this week, and the surprising thing I thought was that Kamala Harris was in third place. For somebody from that maybe people in New Hampshire don't know a lot about. And what was even more surprising is that she was ahead of Elizabeth Warren. And that's going to really be, you know, creating some danger signs in the Warren campaign because she's going to do very well in New Hampshire in order to, you know, that's her backyard. And she's expected to, you know, walk out either winning it or coming in second, but not certainly fourth or fifth.
Yeah, so that's obviously one of the implications of Bernie Sanders getting in the race. New Hampshire now has two neighbors, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. What do you think? Does she need to be top two in New Hampshire to continue?
I think for Democrats as a whole, the best thing that can happen is having a robust field that excites people, that gets people really engaged. Not doing debates on Saturday nights, which happened during the last election cycle.
Brutal.
Which was absolutely horrible. And what it did is it seeded the stage to this pretty exciting slash scary group of folks on the other side. So I think the real issue from a Democratic side is to have a robust primary. And that actually, and if you think about what happened with Clinton, not having a robust primary actually hurt her because she was unable to answer many of the questions that she would have had to answer had there been a robust primary. So this is the best thing that can happen for the Democratic Party. I believe the best ideas will rise to the top. And I look forward to all of these folks getting their fair shake. And you can... by handshakes, some milkshakes, and some pancakes, you can actually move some things in New Hampshire.
That's a good line. I like that.
Thank you. I just made that up.
Long way to go on that, obviously. We'll keep our eyes on the situation in New Hampshire. I want to switch gears here and get to a story that we've been covering all week, and that is housing in Boston. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh announced this week a $26 million investment to maintain existing units and also build almost 500 new ones.
It's one unit at a time. And we want to build more than one unit at a time, but sometimes it's one unit at a time. For whatever reason, whether it's getting the right partners at the table, finding the right funding sources at the table, making sure the community's okay with the projects. These are all challenges that we have every single day, and this is an exciting announcement today.
So what do you make of Mayor Walsh's plan? Is it enough to address the housing issue in Boston?
We have a systemic issue in Boston. I thank Mayor Walsh for these 500 units. Yesterday, ironically, I was in housing court. I was with a friend of mine who has been served an eviction letter by, I consider, a rogue landlord in Boston who's trying to jack her rent over $750 a month. And she's a elderly woman who is battling cancer right now. So I went to court with her. My heart sunk. There were over 200 people that I saw in court. I knew 30 or 40 folks, and most of them were people of color who were being displaced from their homes. So we have a lot of work to do. More affordable housing here. I think there's an opportunity to raise inclusionary zoning policy, which means right currently now you have to, but it's about 15%. We need to get that over 20%. We hear some legislation from Lydia Edwards and Kim Janey, who have proposed a 6% tax for deals over $2 million. In addition, a flipper's tax for 25% flipping tax if you sell it, if it's been sold twice in 2 years. And there's also some legislation from Vancouver that actually has a vacancy tax. So many of the towers that we have, like Millennium Tower, well over 50% of that building actually does not take the homestead, which means that, and I believe it's somewhere around 80% of the people don't take the homestead. That means they don't actually live there, or they're actually putting those out to rent. We need to be thoughtful and creative. Just building more housing doesn't actually solve the actual problem.
Yeah, it's a tough situation. We've talked with not just tenants, but also landlords and property owners, and you kind of have to balance that those rights as well. Richard, how do you see
solution? I'm a real estate broker, so just full disclosure.
Okay.
But I would say that there is an affordability problem, not only in Boston, but in other parts of the state, but probably more so in Boston. And, you know, real estate strictly is supply and demand. And the problem in Boston and other parts of the state is that there isn't enough supply coming online, new housing in all different price levels. And as a result, it's made housing very expensive. And, you know, in Boston in particular, there are so many regulations and the zoning is so tough that most developers don't want to come into the city and be able to build affordable and lower income housing because they just can't make any money overcoming all of that. So I think you have to look at a whole bunch of different solutions. You know, I was at a meeting with Barry Bluestone, the economist from the Dukakis School at Northeastern.
Yep, had him on the show before.
And one of the things he was talking about was to start creating, you know, there are so many units that are being used right now by graduate students, in the city. And one of the suggestions that he had was, and they've done this in other parts of the country, is to get some of the big schools together and build millennial villages, you know, that would, you know, really market themselves towards graduate students. And if you could, you know, if you could free up some of the apartments and rental units across the city that way, you know, that would increase the supply. There are a lot of different things that you can do. Taxing and additional regulations isn't going to be something that's going to be helpful.
So we're actually, other than the last part, I think we're going to agree here on this, but I think there's a couple of other things that we could do to immediately put more units out there. One, to put in some in-law zoning, which would actually allow people to move their in-law apartments and zone for them across the city. That would actually put some more folks in housing, and also basement level apartments. If as long as they have the egress that they need, I think there's a critical component there. And I'll round that out with simply, we must do a better job planning. So if we plan and then change the zoning, then, and mind you, this is going to mess with Richard's money, when it comes down to it, we would then, I've had people tell me it's about 40% in soft costs to actually build something. And again, I don't want to take money out of Richard's pocket. But when it comes down to it, if there was a predictable way to build, and we all agree in this area, these buildings are going to be six stories tall, that actually will be conforming across that area, and people will know what they can build and be able to build faster and cheaper.
All right. Unfortunately, you guys will have to continue that debate off the air. That's Tito Jackson.
Richard's looking at me real hard about messing with his money right now. So.
Thanks so much. Well, that's Tito Jackson, CEO of Vernon Medical and former Boston City Councilor. Tito, thanks so much for the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And also Richard Tessay, former minority leader for the Massachusetts State Senate. Richard, thanks for being here. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Chris Siderick. This is Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.